Whenever you rent or buy a video, you need to be sure that the film you choose is suitable for the audience at home.
Do sit down. We're just about to have some tea.
Ladies and gentlemen, please do not panic, but scream! Scream for your lives!
Hey weirdos, the kettle's boiled. Welcome to Tea for Terror, where we take a favourite horror film and dissect it over a nice cup of tea. I'm your host, Andrew Graves, and my guest today is here to tell us that this may hurt a little. Welcome, Jez Conley. How are you doing?
I'm great, thank you, Andrew. Thank you for inviting me back on to your show. Or did I actually invite myself? I can't remember now. But anyway,
I sort you
good
out.
Good. You're back. Well, I hope your listeners enjoyed the first one that we did of these a few months ago. So it's nice to be back to talk about a different film this time. Something else that's also black and white and strange after doing Dead of Night in the first one. This is an altogether different beast.
Yeah. Well, yes. I mean, yeah, it was good to talk about Dead of Night. And the film we're going to look at today is equally as fascinating and interesting, I think. So what have you been up to? What have you got to tell us?
Oh, well, I can't remember last time whether I mentioned that I'm early retired. I took retirement about 18 months ago. I used to work for a university library. Excuse me. And these days, that means I can do a lot more writing and more of the sort of writing that I enjoy doing, which actually increasingly has been in the form of short fiction. So something happened, I think this is probably quite a common experience actually, during that first lockdown in the pandemic, my mind went to doing fiction. I'd done some previously, but not in any concerted sense. But I just kind of found that I had this appetite for writing short horror fiction. It is horror fiction, I hasten to add. And so that's what I've been doing largely, increasingly. Still doing some bits of non-fiction, got a few things have come out recently, but one of the things I'm hoping will happen in the next few months is a collection of my short stories will get published. I don't want to say too much more because it's not absolutely definitely in the bag, but I've got my fingers crossed that this will appear. And I suppose if I had to categorise the sort of fiction that I write, it tends to be, well, I call it prosaic horror. I'm not sure if I coined the phrase, maybe I did. But it's kind of horror found in the normal, in the very ordinary, in the mundane and the banal. So you'll typically find characters in my stories wheeling a trolley around Lidl. There's no gothic mansions in any of my stuff. It's all very kind of ordinary, and it's the horror behind closed doors, I suppose, what goes on behind that, and ordinary people's lives and the strange and rather odd and weird things that happen behind those closed doors. So that's kind of what I've been doing a lot of recently.
Yeah, it's good. It's weird you say that because I'm in a similar position. I don't want to say anything because nothing's sort of set in stone yet. But I'm working on something at the minute which is very different to what I'd normally be working on. So it's quite exciting. But we'll see. We'll see if it happens, if it comes to fruition. I'm sure it'll get out there at some point. But it's interesting.
One thing I have actually found is that because I still do non-fiction writing, but I found that the more fiction stuff I've written, the way I write that has bled into a lot of the non-fiction. So I wrote something a while ago and the editor came back to it and he described it as autoethnography, which is not a phrase that I've come across before. And so I was, is that what I do? For me, I was just, I'm just writing stuff that is about my sort of childhood memories that I'm kind of dredging up and putting out there. Apparently, there's a term for it, which I didn't know before. So that's what I do. Also, ethnography, apparently.
Well, I think that, once you've sort of set yourself on a path in some way, not that you can't do different things, but I think that, these things come out. That you can't always be in control of that. I used to be, for years I was a performance poet. That's what I did, and I was lucky enough to kind of make a career of it. It's just stupid, really. It shouldn't happen, but I did. But I gave it all up, and because I wanted to write other things, I wanted to write more about films. But I think, whatever I'm writing, whether it's fiction, whether I'm writing about a particular horror film or whatever, it is, regardless of whether I intend it to be or not, it's always poetic. It's always that. There's always that internal rhythm. It's always there. I can't do anything about that. That's just there. And that's not me trying to sound pretentious. It's a thing. You get sort of, you can only, in the same way, I guess, in some ways, it's, obviously the film we're looking at today is very, you could argue quite political in some ways, but it is, I think it's, that's something as well. I always remember, when I was doing the poetry stuff, I remember Simon Armitage once said that, you shouldn't try and write political poetry because your ideology will spill out anyway. This idea of trying to write something which is overtly political is a kind of cack-handed way of doing it, because if you're very strong in your ideology, you can write about a house across the street, and that will inherently contain your ideology. So I think there's something in that. These things, it's almost like that. Going back to that, I can't remember who said it, but it's that idea of a block of marble. The statue's already in there. It's not, you're just finding it. So I
It
love
just
that.
play out that way, doesn't it? That's just how it arises, and there's nothing you can do about it. It's just going to come down that way.
But I think the one thing I think with writing, it is always that thing. One thing, I was always massively into Alan Moore. Alan Moore was a big, massive influence on me. I've always loved his stuff. I've always loved what he has to say, whether on in his comic books, novels, or just in interviews, whatever. I think he's a good guy, and I got to meet him once, which was really
Oh,
nice.
really? Yeah.
The thing that's always struck me about Alan Moore is that the one thing he's always said is, if you want to write, write, and the thing he's always said is, it's th there is he has always smashed through, even though he's kind of like this weird guy and he's into magic and stuff. He's always kind of, in on some levels, he's always smashed through that, the nonsense part of the arts, which I'm against as well. This idea that it's kind of mythic, or it's this idea that it's something that nobody can possibly understand it, unless you're involved in it. Everybody who's writing or whatever is somehow suffering some cosmic crushing form of misery that no one else can understand. And Alan Moore's always cut through that and said, that's bollocks. It's same as car mechanics. The more you work on it, if you work on cars every day, you'll be better at car mechanics in a year. And if you write every day, or if you write as much as you can, or as much as your schedule will allow, you'll be a better writer. And I've always adhered to that. And this sounds ridiculous, but I know a lot of writers, and particularly when I was working on a poetry scene, who didn't actually like the writing process. They liked being on stage and performing. They hated writing. I've always found I love writing. I've always been really lucky. I love it. I've never. I loved sitting down and writing. That's what I do. The
No, I
end
think it's
product
that
is great, but I love actually sitting down and doing
it's the as you say, it's the pretense that you need
it.
to get rid of. You need to throw it away, part that completely. And once you manage to do this, it probably happened to me a few years ago. This is probably again part of the pandemic effect that I probably some years ago thought, well, I should be writing this particular way or that particular way. And then once I kind of just removed that from my way of thinking about things, I actually wrote more. Just more came out. It actually proved to be an obstacle to the creative process. So once you've got that out of the way, I found that it stuff flowed out of me much more sort of smoothly and easily and more successfully, I would say. So I completely agree with your thoughts on that.
And Stephen King as well. I mean, Stephen King once said, and I always use this, is there's no such thing as writer's block. It's just writer's ego. You've got to
Absolutely, yeah.
just accept that what you, the first draft is going to be shite, and just work on it from that. And I, because there is a lot to that. And I, for my sins, whatever, I am very lucky in the fact that one of the other things I do, I teach at a university, so I teach kind of creative writing stuff at a university. And the one thing, always say to students is that, this is a great opportunity because I'm giving you an assignment, which means you have to finish it. Because the biggest crime, wannabe writers, is not finishing anything. It's getting halfway through and thinking this is not genius, so I'm going to scrap it and start again. Yeah. And you never get anywhere. You've got to finish it and understand. Put your ego to one side and realize it's going to be shite. But go
well,
back.
Well,
and
we
make
might
it
actually
brilliant.
Move on to. We might move on to not finishing it when we come to talk about the book that I wrote or co-wrote about the film that we're talking about today.
Right. Okay.
So yes, finishing is important.
Yes. So and obviously, yeah. So now, when I normally get guests on, what I ask them initially is, you know, how they got into horror films. But obviously, you've already been on, so I'm not going to recover that. Okay. So I thought what we'd do is start off by talking about in relation to this film, because this film is kind of it's about the idea. It's the body horror of doubles or replacements, or, you know, this idea of you becoming something else, even if it's just physically different, you know. And I think that is rich, you know, in terms of horror and horror science fiction. It's you know, it's very fertile ground, isn't it? There's lots of stuff, you know. If you're talking about things like the more obvious stuff, like, I mean, more recently you had things like Get Out, but also, you know, things like, you know, Stepford Wives and all of this kind of stuff, and this idea of almost self-improvement or straight this weird fixation on trying to be something different. But then of course there's also the other side of that, is this idea of you know, the our identities being taken by someone else, this idea of the doppelganger, or this you know, more recently you've had films like The Double, and or, you know, even more sort of science fiction horror, obviously, like The Thing. You know, obviously you've written about The Thing. It's all kind of tied up, but it is in the same, you know, even though we might be talking about extremes like The Thing, essentially those kind of horrors, I think they are in some ways the most terrifying, because they are, yeah, I'm not saying we're necessarily going to get taken over by aliens, but the root idea of us not losing control or being taken over, and also, you know, even more terrifying with something like The Thing, we don't even know that we have been taken over.
Oh,
you know?
Absolutely.
And
yeah.
and this
it's the psychology of the notion is what I think is the most frightening thing. However graphically that actually might be realized on the screen, just thinking about this idea that you are no longer the person, or you're no longer perceived as the person who you once were. So who are you? Who am I? We can all think a little bit about that sometimes. We all find ourselves in different situations socially, and maybe we all present a different version of ourselves in different social situations. So we're kind of living that a little bit, with that mild fear about how we're perceived all the time. So this film and many others like it are definitely touching on that ground. But of course, this one does have a degree of graphic content to it as well, which we'll talk about perhaps. But doesn't necessarily need to have that. Just it's the idea, it's the notion that's just quite frightening.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, obviously, you know, films like that, they work on, there are different levels of kind of fear and anxiety that these films, you know, some are more extreme than others. But I think, you know, like you said, I think it's something that's so universal and so terrifying. So yeah, there is that idea of, you know, we could link this into things like dementia or senility, you know, this idea of us getting older. And, you know, Cronenberg talked about that a lot, and he, you know, he talked about the idea of The Fly and things like that, this idea of being corrupted and becoming something we don't want to be, you know, which you can sort of connect to getting older, or, you know, in those kind of more extreme cases of dementia and things like that. So these are, or you know, this idea of, you know, we're all potentially, you know, we talk about sort of able-bodied people and disabilities, but we're all pretty much going to end up being disabled at, you know, on some level. So there are those kind of fears that or just getting older in general, you know, that these are the kind of fears we're tapping into. But I think, you know, what you sort of said there, I think, you know, speaking for myself, you know, I come from You know, my dad was a miner. My mum was a dinner lady. I come from, a very working class sort of background. Grew up on a council estate, but just because of the nature of what I'm into and what I do, I end up mixing with a lot of other, more middle class. Obviously, I work in a university, and that's kind of, a hotbed for sort of middle class attitudes. But I feel like I've always, in some ways, I am, in some ways, I'm similar to the protagonist of the film we're going to be talking about. I'm always trying to adapt because you have to, because you come from a background which is, seen as being, literally lower than other people's backgrounds. You have to kind of try to adapt and play that game, but also try and retain something about yourself as well. It kind of messes with you, and more recently, I don't give a fuck. I'll just do what I want.
That's the benefit of getting a bit older, Andrew. I know
Yeah.
exactly what you're talking about there. One thing I was going to add actually is that as well, before the adapting comes, I suppose, the escaping. And that's very much what this film is about. It's about somebody getting away from their former life to become something else. And I think again, in some small way, if you like, escaped our upbringing and we've kind of gone to university or got a job somewhere or something like that, we've almost become someone and something else. As a result, or maybe we've found what we've had to in order to sort of perpetuate that. So that is why I think there's something about this film that is quite fundamental. This sense of like progression through life and how one has to change in order to sort of get on, it definitely taps into a bit of that. And maybe also where things maybe go wrong as well, which we'll come on to.
Yeah, I mean, you've got any of you other than this film we're going to get to in a second, but what other films do you think that really play effectively with that idea of the body double or this idea of
Well, yeah.
replacement?
The one that I was going to mention actually was before this film was Invasion of the Body Snatchers, which is not really similar in many respects, but it is about duplication and replacement. What's I suppose interesting is that that was made at a time, obviously, first flush of the Cold War, and it speaks to that anxiety, all those anxieties, as many of the films of that sort of period of the 50s did. This film that we're talking about on the podcast came a decade later, 1966, it was released. So actually, came out at a kind of interesting cultural crossroads, and I'm not talking about the West Midlands Motel here, when you had post-war 50s, middle-class, middle-aged, commuter belt, male, experiencing or coming up against 60s counterculture. You do see Flower People in this film, although it's slightly earlier, 66, Summer of Love kind of following year, but you had hippie culture kind of coming through. And so, the timing of this film's release is really interesting in terms of that clash and if you like, the friction that occurs when these two cultures rub together makes it particularly fascinating to me. So yeah, I mean, yeah, that was the one, Invasion of the Body Snatchers, that I had in my mind, but almost to illustrate the difference of how society had moved on from the 50s into the 60s to sort of show, people, viewers, audiences for the film were in a different place by then. And maybe also why it didn't quite, well, it didn't click with audiences or critics actually, when it first came out. I think it's possibly one of those ones where it's maybe a little bit ahead of its time and didn't have an audience at that time. Has come on to have one, of course, since then, but it wasn't terribly well received when it first came out. Perhaps it's because it was actually showing people a little bit too much, a bit too close to the bone about what was happening in their lives, and it was uncomfortable. It's not a comfortable film, which makes it odd and unusual because it's a major Hollywood release. So it's probably the bleakest Hollywood film ever made, arguably. From the studios. So yeah, not a comfortable ride. And I use the word ride for a particular reason, but yeah, as we'll come on to pick it apart shortly.
Okay, well, I think it's about time to introduce it then. So the film we're going to look at today is from all the way back in 1966. And it's a film called Seconds, as directed by John Frankenheimer.
Hey, John. Hey, John. Why are they staring at me like that?
They know.
They know what?
They're like you. Reborns.
Oh, Laura!
So, Jez, when was the first time you came across this film?
So I couldn't give you the exact date, but it was one of those films that I have to thank Channel 4, the early days of Channel 4, for screening. So this would have been in the mid-80s, I think. I think they showed it late on one Sunday evening. And I happened to, I don't think I'd even heard of it before. I wasn't really into cinema in the way that I am now back then. Well, I was getting to be that way. I think I was just trying to think about it actually earlier on. Back in 1981, like many people, I was a big fan of the Human League, and their Dare album came out, and there was a track on Dare called Seconds. Now, I didn't know that. I don't think it actually had anything to do with the movie. It's possible. I know that Bill Oakey was a bit of a fan of sort of science fiction, so he may well have seen this, but I think the song was a reference to the assassination of JFK. In fact, it took us seconds of your time to take his life. That was one of the lyrics. Anyway, when I saw the film in the schedule, I thought, oh, is it anything to do with that? It actually wasn't, but there is, again, as we can come on to talk about it, there is a link between the Kennedys and Frankenheimer that's very interesting. So mid-80s, I would say, Channel 4 showed it, and I didn't know what to expect. I sat up late one night on my own, and so this just absolutely just turned me inside out. I couldn't quite believe that I hadn't even heard of the film before. And I think part of the appeal of it was that it seemed almost hidden away. Part of that was to do with its reception when it first came out, and it was really quite tucked away and was very underseen, I would say. Still, I think probably remains a bit underseen as well, which is one of the reasons why I wanted to write the book about it, to give it a bit more oxygen. So, yeah, I was just pretty much blown away by it when I first saw it.
Yeah, Seconds to me, it's a weird one for me, because actually I didn't actually get round to seeing it till very, very recently, you know. However, I had been aware of this film for a long time, and like a lot of those, there are a few books I had, which I've mentioned a few times growing up, you know, film books about horror films. So obviously there's the pictorial history of horror, you know, your Dennis Gifford book and your Alan Frank book, you know, your Movie Treasury of Horror. They were the big ones. But also my brother also had Philip Strick's Movie Treasury of Science Fiction Movies. And there's a still in that, page 48 and 49, of one of the final scenes where they've got, you know, Rock Hudson, and they've got the rubber band in his mouth. And all that, I just thought that, you know, a lot of the other bits of the book are about aliens and all this kind of stuff. And then you've got this image almost in the middle of the book, which is just, it's a very disturbing image, you know.
And it is. I often think about it. It's not so much, I mean, I don't think of it particularly as a horror film, but it's horrible, what it is. It's a horrible film.
It is. And I think it's one scene, you're not going to forget it. I can kind of get why it wasn't popular at the time. Because and it's interesting. I think it's just, it's absolutely brilliant, and it works, and it's one of the most important science fiction films. I know that word sounds really stupid, but it is. It really is fucking. It really does affect you. You can't not be affected by this film. It will. You know, you'll. It will leave you with your chin on the floor. It's really strong. It's strong stuff. So I can understand why it possibly wasn't. People didn't lap it up then. The timing of it as well. I think 1966 was a really important year as well, and just in terms of the way, you know, the idea of rock and roll and music changing, and the counterculture was becoming kind of like culture, if you like, and all of these things were happening very, very fast in 1966, and it all kind of sped up quite quickly. And by the time you get to 69, it's kind of all over again, you know, and it's we're dealing with the hangover of the 60s going into the more depressing 70s. So it's key, but I think it was, like you said, it was very, it was perhaps too ahead of its time, but it is absolutely a fantastic film.
Yeah, I mean, it's Eye of the Storm stuff for me, and in the book I describe it as a necessary entertainment, which makes it sort of it's a tough watch. It is entertaining, very entertaining, but it's so raw and worrying, if you like, that it's not an easy watch in any way. It really from the get go, it's quite tough to kind of watch this character descend, really, frankly, most of the time out of his control, beyond his control, and you know, again, you reflect back on your own experiences, and you just think, you just the degree to which, and I think this keeps it contemporary and fresh, is the degree to which we even now we feel we're not in control of our destiny, and that other shadowy figures are somehow pulling the strings on us, and it speaks to that. I think it's, you know, it's over 50 years old, and it was doing that back then. Is amazing, but as I say, and that's why probably people at the time thought, "Why, well, it's not for me," because it's kind of lifting the lid on all of that, and people didn't want to see it, I don't think, back then.
Well, I mean, to in some ways, I mean, it's a very different film in a lot of ways, but in some ways, this feels like it's very much an American version of something like Eyes Without a Face, the French film. If you look at, because I mean, the French, you know, I'm generalizing here, you know, but in terms of French cinema, obviously you've got French New Wave and things like that, but this idea of them, it was almost like they wanted to do horror by proxy. They didn't want to do like upfront horror films because that was maybe seen as being a bit too crass. And so you had these films like a little bit before you had like Les Diaboliques, which is, you know, very much a psychological thriller, but it has these kind of these a lot of people who were making horror films later on looked at that film and took a lot of that and put it into their horror films and create, you know, different kinds of horror films. But certainly with something like Franju's Eyes Without a Face, I mean, that is, it's taking this idea of it is a science fiction horror film, but it's also haunting and it's kind of beautiful, but it's brutal as well. And I think that is the similar vibe you get in this film. It's got this kind of this, you know, obviously with what the film's talking about, this surface level sort of vanity. You know, here's a guy who actually becomes Rock Hudson. You know, he looks like Rock Hudson, which is brilliant casting. And it's just that, you know, he literally becomes Rock Hudson. He's got this perfect body, he's got this perfect life, and it's still not good enough. He's still searching for this existential something which he's going to never find and never be satisfied with. But I think, you know, that but it takes, in a similar way to what Eyes Without a Face did, it takes this idea of something quite haunting and something quite abstract, but also it has this brutality as well. You know, the even though it's not as brutal as Eyes Without a Face, but certainly during those early scenes of the operations where they're sculpting his face, you know, this plastic surgery stuff, that it does make you feel very, you know, you can always feel the pain he's going through and the stitches and the healing. You know, it is a more realistic version of that. It's not just simply, oh, we're taking him into the operating table and two hours later he's completely different and he's fine. It does show you that this is an actual physical operation and
Yeah,
there is
but it
pain
was actually,
involved.
you know, this was real. This was a real surgical procedure that was filmed. I don't know if you read about that, but they made a point of actually going into a real operating theatre and filming, you know, genuine operation. The myth is that the original camera operator fainted, passed out during this, and Frankenheimer himself actually took hold of the camera and carried on shooting. I was actually thinking the other day about the film's black and whiteness. It's quite late for 66, quite late for black and white. I mean, it actually was, you know, economically cheaper to make films in colour back, you know, there weren't that many black and white films being made. But I think the main reason why they made it in black and white was because the scenes of surgery, you know, if that had been in colour and the real blood was on the screen, I think the censors might have had a bit of a problem with that. So that explains what was black and white, I suspect. But Rock Hudson, I think that was one of the, again, going back to audience reception at the time, I think the central conceit of seeing the rather portly, short actor John Randolph transformed into the 10 years younger, 10 feet tall Rock Hudson was a bit hard to stomach in terms of believability and plausibility. I never had a problem with it. I think it was great casting as well. But I think that's possibly another reason why it wasn't so well received at the time.
I think, again, like, you know, 66 was interesting because if you think about, I'm not saying they were necessarily physically connected or anything, but it's just interesting that this stuff was happening at the same time. So if you think about, say Doctor Who in this country, you know, think about that, you know, this is 66, 65, 66. That's around the time that you start to see Cyberman appear on Doctor Who. And these, it taps into those same fear, you know, this is around the same time when plastic surgery was becoming much more of a widespread thing. And this idea of you literally can change your identity and, or, you know, sculpt yourself to look very, very different, or, you know, try and be something that you aren't. And I think that, you know, something like Cybermen and something like this film absolutely taps into that. And I think later on, one of my favorite kind of films that completely flies under the radar, and it had I think it's Powerhouse released it, Indicate released it fairly recently. But it was a film it's one of those films that had about 10 different titles. So I was constantly trying to find it. And it used to come up on BBC Two every now and again in the 80s. It was a film called Who. I don't know if you're aware of that film.
Vaguely. Now you said Who. I've got a vague memory, but I cannot remember anything other than
it's
the title.
Brilliant. It's really good. It's great. It's got, it's basically, you've got an American scientist, and he gets captured by the Russians, you know, so it's height of the Cold War, sort of early 70s. And they arranged, the film starts with them arranging to have, they're getting him back. So they're exchanging one of their people they've captured, a Russian, and they're going to swap. And so they get this guy back. But when they get the guy back, he's got basically a metal face.
And okay. Reconstructive
surgery on him, and the whole film is, well, is this the guy or isn't it? And at the end of the day, it's kind of like, well, does it matter? You know, it's this guy now. You know, it's really interesting. It's a brilliant. Yeah. It's really, really flies under the radar, that film.
Yeah,
but I've always
loved you mentioned Doctor Who just make me think. Actually, 1966, of course, was the year that William Hartnell became Patrick Troughton. Now, I'm not suggesting that John Frankenheimer was a big Doctor Who fan or anything like that, but it's interesting that was the same year that this film was released, that one man became another man. I hadn't thought about that.
Yes, yeah, and I think, because I think it was the Cybermen were introduced. I think that was the last William Hartnell story. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, so Troughton came along after the Cybermen had been introduced for the first time, if I remember right. Mm-hmm.
That's great.
And, also as well, you know, obviously we can get back into this, but John Frankenheimer, I mean, this is the mad thing, I think, because obviously, you know, we talked about body horror replacement films, but obviously if you think about, you know, the original, the granddaddy of that really is your sort of Island of Dr. Moreau, H.G. Wells. Then you've got this weird this weird little story, you know, this all these little enclaves and these avenues. So you've got the original Island of Dr. Moreau by H.G. Wells. Now this is followed up fairly quickly by Hearts of Darkness by Joseph Conrad, you know, and Wells has a big beef with Conrad for saying, well, I think you ripped my story off here, you know. You know, and then that later on, obviously Hearts of Darkness becomes Apocalypse Now, the Francis Ford Coppola film. Now that is notorious for having a ridiculously mental production, you know, people going mad and having heart attacks and all this kind of stuff, a ridiculously bad, and obviously, you know, Marlon Brando is at the heart of that, as he always is. And then, you know, whiz on a bit, you've got, you know, Island of Dr. Moreau, Richard Stanley. Now, again, you've got Marlon Brando at the heart of that. Again, it's a notoriously bad production. Terrible sort of storms and casting choices, and Val Kilmer and Marlon Brando going at it, and then of course Richard Stanley himself becomes replaced by Frankenheimer in some
Yeah.
sort of weird sort of foreboding sort of, this is, it's almost like what's happening there had been sort of foreshadowed in seconds. It's
Yeah.
all of these ideas, these connections, it fascinates me.
Well, I absolutely see that, Frankenheim's involvement in that film has been very much part of his descent in terms of quality. I mean, he did one or two reasonably good ones later on. Ronin was not too bad, but I mean, yeah, there was a definite decline after the, well, let's say after the early 70s. I think by and large is for very good reasons, which we might talk about in a bit. His work became less great. I think I do tend to think that Seconds is his prime achievement, really. I mean, I would say that, wouldn't I? But I do think it's possibly his greatest film.
It's an incredible film, and I hope in some ways, whoever's listening to this, if they haven't seen it, I know we're going to spoil certain things, but obviously, if you haven't
It's
seen
an
it,
unavoidable.
stop listening to this now. Go and watch it and come back, because it is just such a it's it, you know you've got a lovely Eureka Masters Cinema version of it now. There's no excuse. It's just a fucking great film. But I like you say, it has flown under the radar. I mean, I. This possibly came on television when I was younger, but I wouldn't have been aware of it necessarily through seeing, or even though I knew the sort of image, but I wouldn't have necessarily gone to it straight away. So it probably was it, but like I said, I didn't see it till fairly recently, and I'm so glad.
It had very few screenings pre, digital channels. So I count myself lucky to actually caught it that one night in the mid-80s on Channel 4. I mean, you mentioned about first viewings. I've got an opportunity to talk about the Brian Wilson connection, Brian Wilson of the Beach Boys. I mean, he this came out. I think he just released the Smile album, sort of to great applause. And but I think, as you is well documented, again, he was going through quite a serious psychological crisis around that sort of time. He went to see Seconds when it's on at the cinema, but he walked in partway through the film, and he. According to his biography, anyway, the first thing that he heard on the screen when he went in was someone say, "Hello, Mr. Wilson, come this way, please," or something to that effect, whatever the actual line. And he assumed it was related to him, so he had this kind of complete paranoid moment. And actually, I think that probably was the time his output started to go into some weird flux. And so the timing of that was, he didn't see another film for about 16 years when he went to see E.T. the Extraterrestrial. So make of that what you will. But yeah, that's definitely affected him in a very, very personal level. Just a complete coincidence about this the surnames, but there it is.
So you wrote a whole book on Seconds, which, yes, he's holding up now, which I haven't read, I have to be honest. I do want to read it, and life permitting, I would have read it before this podcast, but life seldom works out the
Right.
way we wanted to. But
That's okay.
I definitely want to read it, seriously. It's because I think, not enough has been written about this film by any stretch, I don't think. So I think I really do want to read it. But I'm just wondering, just curious as to how you approach the book. Why? I mean, you've talked about that it's kind of a film that flies under the radar, so you wanted to cover it. But I wondered if there was any other reasons why you wanted to cover it, and what kind of things, was there anything that came up when you were researching and writing the book that you weren't aware of before that were kind of surprising or interesting, or so I'm after some nuggets, really.
Oh, sure, yeah, I've got plenty of those. So I actually started writing this. I was thinking about it in 2016. I'd just come off the back of doing the Dead of Night book that we talked about in the previous podcast, and I thought, well, what other films do I really think deserve a book dedicated to them in its entirety. And this really was the top of the list. It was the go-to one for me because it was just one of those films. Since that early viewing back in the 1980s, it had completely stayed with me. And I think I might have actually recorded the film when it screened that night. I watched this ancient videotape to destruction pretty much throughout the 90s. And I'd gone without a copy for the longest time. And I think you might have mentioned the DVD release in about 2013. So I managed to get a good copy then. That was the first time I've seen it for quite a while. And I thought, well, it's got to be this one. But also, I said, just again, the ego creeping in a little bit. I wanted to be the first person to actually write a single dedicated monograph to this one film in various contexts, different chapters and articles and that before this. But I don't think there's another book entirely dedicated to it before this one came out. So that was my thing. So that was 2016. And I kind of put it along for about 2 years. And I got to the stage where kind of written just over about half of it, and I just totally ground to a halt. So this is 2018. I just lingering. I just couldn't get it moving again. So it sat in abeyance for probably about 18 months, and then I made contact with Emma Westwood, the Australian film writer, who she contributed a book about Cronenberg's The Fly to Auteurs Devil's Advocates range of books, which are a terrific range of books, as I'm sure you're aware. Go out and buy them all now, everybody. And we just got chatting about projects, and I said, look, I've got this one, it's half done, and I just can't get it going again. Is it something that would interest you? And she just jumped on it straight away. And so it was another 2 years roughly before it eventually did actually appear. And what's nice about it now, so the Dead of Night book, you might recall, was a co-written volume, but that was by design. And in fact, actually, because of the episodic nature of that film, it lent itself quite nicely to a portioning of who was going to write which bit. That was fine. That was the design from the outset. But for the seconds, it wasn't by design. It was out of necessity. But given the nature of the film, I think it became interesting to have two different people's take on this one film kind of fused together, which somewhat mimics the nature of the film. So I think the end result is more interesting as a result of that rather protracted writing process. Now, in terms of nuggets of things that I didn't know before, I think, again, I learned a bit more about John Frankenheimer as a result of researching for the book. I think back at the beginning, you mentioned about the political nature of the film. You probably know, but it was actually the third film in a loose trilogy, which has come to be regarded as Frankenheimer's paranoia trilogy. The first two films being the very well-known The Manchurian Candidate. The second one, a bit less known, is the 7 Days in May.
Yeah.
Those two films, I think, were quite overtly political. If you've seen them,
7 Days in May is fantastic.
It definitely brings doors on
Rod Serling screenplay as well.
That's it. That's the one. But they both definitely draw upon the geopolitical situation of the time. Now, I think by comparison to those two films, Seconds is actually that bit less directly political. I mean, it is, as we were saying at the beginning, it's within the whole political milieu, if you like. It comes from that. It speaks to that time. But it's not really picking up these directly political threads from those two previous films, which actually I would argue makes it the most interesting of the three. Again, I would say that, wouldn't I? But I do think that is the case. And I learned quite a bit about Frankenheimer's own political inclinations and his links to the Kennedy family. So possibly not surprisingly, JFK, when he was still alive, I think he was something of a fan of Manchurian Candidate, and there is something quite prescient, I think, about some of that in terms of what happened to JFK, as we know. And then Bobby Kennedy was actually one of Frankenheimer's friends and associates. In fact, he got Frankenheimer to direct some of the sort of broadcasts and films that were designed to promote Bobby Kennedy's run for the presidency in 1968. So the story goes that the beach house that features in the film, in Seconds, the Malibu Beach House, was actually John Frankenheimer's own home. He owned that house at the time of the film's making. So it was, the story goes that he was actually staying at Frankenheimer's residence on that night before. He was watching the voting happen on the TV. And he was actually a little bit reluctant to go and do speeches because he was quite confident he was going to win. But it was actually Frankenheimer who I think persuaded him to take the drive to the Ambassador Hotel to meet the press and be seen. And in fact, he actually drove him, Frankenheimer drove Kennedy to the hotel. And as history of Frankenheimer's own state of mind, and that's where I think the decline began to happen. That was clearly, he was there when that happened. He was, you know, central to a bit of history being made. And I think it had its impact, shall we say. So, yes, it was a fascinating figure, Frankenheimer. So I learned more about him from writing this book, I would say.
I wasn't aware of that. That's crazy, you know. It's almost story that sticks in my mind from that whole Kennedy thing is that I'm sure I've not dreamt this. I'm sure this is true. But when Jack Ruby was killed live on TV, I'm sure that John Peel, as a young man, he was there when Ruby was killed. I'm sure I've not made that up. I'm sure that's right.
Was it the Ruby killing, or was it the Lee Harvey?
It might have been the Lee Harvey. Yeah, sorry, probably.
Yeah, that's what I'd heard.
It's mental. I mean,
I've watched the video footage, and I can't see Peel in the background. But maybe, who knows? These things can be so apocryphal. But I think it might be true.
Yeah. He was probably in the background looking at an obscure psychedelic mid-60s album or something. I think that in some ways, this film, Seconds, it's without being overtly political, it's and whatever John Frankenheimer's politics were or whatever, it says something about the state of America. You know, it's not about left-wing Democrat or Republican. It's just that there is something, as the best sort of sci-fi horror films do, there is something amiss. There is something not right about this. And I think what's happened a lot, I mean, obviously we've gone to the extremes now where politics in America has become it makes no sense. It's beyond satire, beyond parody now. But I think that there has been this long-standing thing in America, particularly with, we can sort of debate about left-wing and right-wing politics or whatever, and we can pick up the obvious things that are wrong with extreme right-wing politics and all that. But I think there's been a big thing with kind of more liberal-leaning people that is kind of just as bad in a way. And I think that starts with this. I think Oliver Stone has got a lot to answer for. Now, as much as I enjoy a lot of Oliver Stone's films, and he's a good director, it's almost like it's Oliver Stone and people like Alan Sorkin, you know, on television. It's all this idea that everything in America was great up until they assassinated Kennedy, and then it all went weird and strange and horrible. And it's like, that's just not true. It negates your history. Look at your fucking country. You wiped out an indigenous people and then became, you know, masters of the world via the slave trade. You know, this is it's a nonsense. And I think films like Seconds, as much as it's not trying to be overtly political, it cuts through that, and it makes you, this is a truly dystopian film. You know, it's a dystopian film that isn't set in a future. It's set, you know, that it could conceivably happen within the society, the time it's made in.
Yeah. I mean, obviously it was a modern day Faustian pact story, really. You could say, but I think it absolutely spoke to then and to now. And I think it was also quite prescient as well. I mean, you know, you've got the company you know, the sinister organization known as the company, which is behind, you know, the procedure that the central character goes through, which way predates. You think about a lot of films from the 1980s, you've got your Weyland Yutani from the Alien films, you've got Omni Consumer Products from the Robocop, for all of those sort of shadowy organizations. You find that in the form of the company in seconds. So it way predates all of that stuff, and I think definitely informs it. I think a lot of those films drew upon this idea for, but it's essentially it is a Faustian pact story. You know, the devil is the company in the film.
Yeah, and I think, you know, like I said, Rock Hudson, it's great cast. I mean, a really interesting choice for him. I mean, obviously he'd come, you know, he wasn't the only thing he did, but, you know, most people would associate Rock Hudson with those Doris Day films, you know, those kind of more lighthearted sort of rom-com type things from the 50s and early 60s. But obviously, you know, he's a good actor. He's got that, you know, he's got some acting chops. But I think this, and again, given what we understood about Rock Hudson later on in the sort of 80s and 90s, and, you know, suddenly we're finding another layer to Rock Hudson, you know, when he's kind of outed, if you like, fairly or unfairly, or however you want to look at that. Again, it this film, yeah, okay, we can go back and we can read things into different films, and we can layer it up with different things which weren't necessarily intended, but just as something that happened and has been put out there, and in retrospect, it's got this like you said, it's so prescient, and there's so many things that you can look reference now to things that happened later or are happening now, that you can look back at this film and think, well, Jesus, how did they know? There's some sort of dark magic going on there, I think.
Yeah. Well, there's little doubt in my mind that this is the reason why Hudson was attracted to the brand. Obviously, he was high, but I think it definitely appealed to him. He was at a point in his career where things were starting to go downhill a little bit. I mean, the heyday of the romantic comedies was starting to wane. It wouldn't be right to say that the Seconds was the point at which his career went into decline. I think it was already happening the year before. A couple of films came out, they didn't do terribly good box office. But I think they may have provoked him to looking for other different types of projects. And I think this would have appealed to him, given that, as we know now, you know, he was living this something of a double life and a hidden away. And I think he probably saw something in the story of Seconds that spoke to his own personal experience of you know, having to be somebody else, really, for the public consumption. So it doesn't surprise me. And I do actually think this is his best performance. You know, I can't think of another film that he was in. It was better than this. He was really stretched in many ways. He was stretched for this performance. And I think he did it fantastic justice. And he was also a great advocate for the film as well. So when it played out of competition, I think, in the Cannes Film Festival, the year of its release, and was famously booed by the audience who saw it, but Hudson was there, and he stood up and defended it, and he continued to for the rest of his career and his life. Really, he was a big advocate of this film, so it meant a lot to him, I think it's fair to say.
Yeah, and I guess it's weird, isn't it? I think, but sometimes actors, they become the thing, obviously, that they become the most famous for, that stays, and they can end up being typecast. And I think sometimes, you know, for most people, I guess Seconds, if anything, would become like a footnote. You know, it's the kind of thing that if you see these kind of Sky Arts documentaries, you know, they'll do one on Rock Hudson or whatever, and they'll probably spend like 10 seconds talking about Seconds, you know. And it's something that kind of depresses me. I know I lean into a certain kind of film, but it's like, you know, if ever there's a film that has an actor who's not really known for that kind of film, you know, I'm attracted to it straight away if it's a horror science fiction thing.
Sure, yeah.
But if I ever come across in a charity shop, I come across their biography or autobiography, I always go to the index and think, well, how much are they going to say about this? If they got more than one or two pages on the film I really liked, I'll probably buy it. But usually it's not. I would guess. I mean, you may have come across this in your research, but I don't know how, you know, whether you came across Rock Hudson's autobiography or biography or whatever, and whether there was anything in there, you know.
Yeah, I mean, definitely, I did get that and read it, and there was stuff in there which wasn't speaking about Second. I mean, there's quite a bit of Seconds in there, actually, which is quite good. But there's other conversations that were recorded in his autobiography, which definitely, I haven't got it in front of me now, I can do it word for word, but suggest that he was looking to, you know, change, to have a different kind of a life, because I think he just got to a point where he just couldn't live the lie anymore, and he just wanted to be somebody else almost. So, you know, it's totally consistent with the film. Just thinking back to its poor reception when it came out as well. Also, Hudson's casting, I think, probably was another reason why it didn't do such great business. Rock Hudson fans probably thought, well, I don't like science fiction, didn't go and see it. Science fiction fans thought, it's got Rock Hudson in it, I don't want to go and see that. So, you know, it's kind of, commercially, it was a bit of a wrong step. But I think now we can look at it and think, no, actually, it was perfect. It was the ideal casting for that main role.
That again, I mean, that casting, that's another thing that's ahead of its time. You know, if you look at what Tarantino was doing, you know, 30 years mm-hmm. later, that's very similar, you know, taking someone like, you know, Travolta and sticking him into Pulp Fiction. And he's kind of done that all the way through his career. I think, you know, that's kind of what we look for in a Tarantino, one of the things we look for in a Tarantino film. So that in itself, but I think that idea of, for me, even if it didn't do commercially well, it wasn't successful, for me, that is a perfect bit of casting. And I just think what they were trying to do with that is that's so forward thinking and just clever, and you know, it's just this idea, yeah. Like I said, you know, mentioned earlier on, this, you take this kind of, like, you know, flabby sort of middle-aged, fairly short, gray, balding guy, and you turn him into Rock Hudson, you know, and he's still not happy, he can't fit in. It's just, it's, you know, like, this film is similar to slightly earlier, I mean, it, obviously it's not a science fiction film, but if you look at those kind of British New Wave films from the late 50s, early 60s, you know, particularly something like Saturday Night, Sunday Morning, which I've written a lot about in the past, you know, I love that film. But that, you know, what people tend to forget about that is that, you know, all these famous kind of sayings from it, whatever you say, I'm not, and, you know, don't let the Gap bastards grind you down. But to me, the key thing in that, relating to this film, I guess, is that there's a line right at the end of that film after Arthur Seaton's been beat up by the squaddies, and he's looking in, and he's in his bedroom, and he's looking in the mirror, and there's a voiceover, and he says, I don't know what the hell I am. And it's that, you know, the, all the way through the film, you have this swagger, you know, Arthur Seaton is about yeah. swagger and womanizing, and but at the end, he's having just as big an existential crisis as he hasn't got the words to describe it, because he comes from a different background, but it's the same as the character in Seconds. He is having an existential yeah. crisis. It's a 60s existential crisis.
I think it's a crisis that had been happening since the end of the Second World War, you know, men returning from fighting, and you know, what was their role in life. And I think that was happening, you know, well, certainly in the Western world that was the case. I was thinking back to a film, American film in the 50s called The Man in the Grey Flannel Suit. I don't know if you've seen that one.
Yes.
Gary Cooper, I think it is. It's not science fiction in any way, but it's absolutely that kind of, you know, middle-class, middle-aged, hey, honey, I'm home, kind of commuter belt story of a character who wants to be something more than he actually is, which absolutely is what Seconds is all about, isn't it? So it's ingrained. It was ingrained in the culture. I think there probably still is in many respects. For many people, particularly men, actually, still to this day, you know, you could say. So well, yeah.
I think as well, you know, it came a little bit later on, but a film like, you know, Burt Lancaster in The Swimmer, you know, that's, you know, yeah. again, you're taking this Hollywood icon and placing them into this really odd film, and it's about this midlife, middle-aged existential crisis, you know, and with that brilliant shocking ending as well. But I think as well, like you said, I think, yeah, it is something that really sort of came to the fore after the Second World War, in that post-war period. I think it happens slightly later on in this country with those kind of British New Wave dramas. But I think if you look at a lot of the later film noir productions, you know, they During the war, you had these kind of film noir productions, which were kind of very much your hardball detective, and they were, you're based on your Chandlers and all that. But then slightly later on, you got these really interesting sort of these Alan Ladd, not always Alan Ladd, but Alan Ladd or Burt Lancaster, whoever. These kind of film noir productions, which were about the returning soldier and not them not finding a place in society anymore. They've come back, their wives are seeing other people, or their girlfriends are seeing other people. The country's changed, they don't fit into that. It's a very sort of, it's almost like a subgenre of a subgenre, those kind of returning males after the Second World War films. There is a really interesting part of the whole film noir sort of structure, because we think of film noir, we think femme fatale, we think of, Bogart and all these people, these kind of hardball detective dramas. That's one side of it, but another big thing is this kind of the returning guy from the Second World War.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we can probably safely assume that the John Randolph character, Arthur Hamilton, that she was just the character that becomes Tony Wilson, played by Rock Hudson, probably did fight in the war as well. Just another thing that occurs to me, actually, in terms of political as well, of the time, is that quite a lot of the actors and the crew who worked on Seconds were very much involved in the post-war, what was that, Committee for American Activity stuff. All those sort of show trials and everything, including John Randolph, actually, Jeff Corey, who's prominent part in the film as well, quite a few others. Was Frankenheimer deliberately employing a lot of those people who were involved in that kind of, supposedly communist inspired activity, which makes it quite political, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, because you can't get away from it. Anybody that's going out their way to say that they aren't political, I always say, well, that's a very political thing to say. So yeah, it is.
That's great. Yeah,
that's very interesting. That's very political.
Yeah, isn't it?
I think, put all politics to one side, whatever you sit on the political spectrum, this film works on a human level. There is some, I think, like, yeah, particularly, I mean, possibly, I'm sticking my neck out here, I don't know this, but possibly the other reason it didn't do well is that I'm not sure there is anything really in this film for a female audience. I think that there's something very, I don't mean in a sexist way, but I think it's a male story. And I think it's a male story in a way that you probably wouldn't be, maybe quite rightly, you wouldn't be able to tell now, because there is nothing else. It's just a very, very, there's something very male and very, it's the idea of the masculine versus the emasculated, it's all this kind of stuff in there. So I don't, it's not a date film, is it?
Without a doubt, without a doubt. We were lucky enough, Emma managed to make contact with Salome Jens, the main actor, is in part in the book. And so that was quite an enlightening sort of take on the production, I think. There's Arthur Hamilton's Winnie. You see one or two nurses in the company's clinic. But other than that, and a few kind of party guests later on, there are hardly any women in this film, which, possibly dates it. But I still think, even today, there is room for movies that talk to the male experience, because I think it can be quite eviscerating and opening and interesting. Although it might date it, I still think it keeps it quite relevant in many respects.
Yeah, because I think the temptation, it's really difficult, because I think representation, even if it's surface level representation, I think it's important in particularly in mainstream Hollywood. I think the danger is when it is just about surface level and there's nothing else going on. But I do think, like you said, I think I want necessarily to have films that are just completely male for the sake of it. But I think there's room for those stories in the same way there are room for all female stories, I've got for one reason or another, I was watching Glengarry Glen Ross again the other day, and I just thinking, Would we be able to do that now? I don't know, but it's so vital that there are no women in that. Not again, it's not a sexist thing, it's just this is the nature of the story. This is a pissing contest between these fairly
Definitely.
in stupid guys, coming together in this pissing. That's the point, it's
Yeah, exactly right. Exactly. Well, it's not as though either of these films, that Glengarry Glen Ross or Seekers, are saying, "Here's malehood, great, isn't it?" It's not saying that. It's the
No.
opposite of that. It's just saying this is hell. This is absolute hell. This is the lived experience for many, many men, and it's not in a good way. It's awful. And there it is. That's life for many men.
Well, it was kind of
But
like,
in the good news.
but it was like to me, Red Dwarf, the sitcom. I mean, that was always the moment you began to introduce other characters and it became more of an ensemble piece with other, you got your Kachansky. That's when it kind of it died, not because the female character was any was no good. No, she's fine, but it was just that the nature of it, the point was it was kind of porridge in space. This is about three blokes bickering at each other. That was the point, that they were never going to get a shag. That was the whole point. So I don't know. It's a strange one, but I think it's such a
Well, having said that, I was still say that it doesn't matter what sex you are, you can still derive a lot from. There are some universal themes being explored, I think, both men and women, particularly increasingly men and women, both men and women will experience that life of being a part of the system. So I think we can all derive something from watching a film like Seconds. The whole experience is a bit like being strapped onto a conveyor belt, isn't it? It's
Yeah.
throughout, and it's this lack of the option to escape it, which I think is pretty universal. When I was watching it for the book, it struck me that both in the Arthur Hamilton phase of the guy's life and in the Tony Wilson phase, both of these manifestations of the character are frequently not in control of their circumstances. I mean, literally, you frequently see them being driven, often being driven by women, actually, to or up to their next phase of their life. Or if they're not being driven, they're actually being strapped to a gurney and wheeled down a corridor, aren't they? So they're never in control, and it's almost like they're on a kind of fun house or a ghost train ride, and they can't get off it. And it's this inability to escape, which I think is one of these universal things that we can all, I was going to say enjoy, but that's not quite the right word, but just feel is relevant to our existence.
It's just, I think it's just such a shocking film. It's still it because it's kind of unapologetic, and the ending.
We're coming
Christ,
to that,
yeah.
aren't we? I can tell.
I mean, it's such a wallop, isn't it? I mean there are certain, I mean, for those that have maybe not seen it, I mean, there are some, you've got this shadowy company that does these procedures, and it's kind of like you have the protagonist who receives this note at the beginning of the film, and he goes to this company, and it's basically all set in place, and he's so, he's not sh it's almost like he's saying, well, I don't know if I want to do this, but it's almost like the Noam Chomsky thing, the illusion of choice. He doesn't really have a choice. He's involved in this thing whether he wants to be or not, so he goes along with it. But there is this kind of this brilliant scene. Well, there's a scene at the beginning and a scene towards the end of the film where there's this like waiting room where we don't know at first, but there's a waiting room full of people who are waiting to have the procedure. And he kind of tries to make contact with them initially, and they're not making eye contact. They're not talking to him, so that we know there's something weird going on. But then we find out at the end that it's actually one of his the friend that originally recommended him to the company. He's in this waiting room, and he gets to talk to him at the end. And we think that the protagonist is going to go off. Wilson's going to go off and get another body because that's what he's waiting for, but that's not what happens, is it?
Well, I always think it's the whole thing is like a kind of a Ponzi scheme, isn't it? That
yes,
that actually the failure of each of the procedures is kind of integral to the success of the company.
I have a gentleman here who wishes to leave the building.
Isn't it easier to go forward when you know you can't go back? Begin again, all new, all different.
Well, unfortunately, that's where we lost Jez due to a dodgy internet connection. So it just remains for me to say thank you to Jez for coming on and being such a brilliant guest. And also to say, remember to call round next time. Make yourself at home. You look like you're dying for a nice cup of tea for terror.
And remember, my friend, future events such as these will affect you in the future.